From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Homosexuality is not just taboo in much of the Middle East. In many countries, it's a crime. Punishments range from flogging to imprisonment and death. On today's Fresh Air, Brian Whitaker talks about his new book, Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. He's the Middle East editor for the British newspaper, The Guardian. According to Whitaker, Israel is the most open country for gays and lesbians, but there's a lot of opposition to gay rights in Jerusalem. We'll talk with Noah Satat, the executive director of a group that organizes an annual gay pride parade in Jerusalem that has been met with violence. Also, Milo Miles reviews the music of Brazilian singer and bandleader Marisa Monche. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Brian Whitaker, has written a book about a subject that is seldom discussed, gay and lesbian life in the Middle East. Whitaker is the Middle East editor for the British newspaper The Guardian. In his book, Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East, he writes, "Homosexuality is a subject that Arabs, even reform-minded Arabs, are generally reluctant to discuss. If mentioned at all, it's treated as a subject for ribald laughter or, more often, as a foul, unnatural, repulsive, un-Islamic Western perversion." According to Whitaker, there is no uniform Islamic position regarding homosexuality and the law, but a majority of the countries in the Islamic Conference Organization and the Arab League outlaw sex between same-sex partners. The punishments vary. In the past decade, three countries, Afghanistan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, have executed people for sodomy. Brian Whitaker, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you decide to write a book focusing on gay and lesbian life in the Middle East?
Well, the initial trigger was an incident in 2001 when the Egyptian police raided a nightclub in Cairo, a floating nightclub on the River Nile, and more than 50 allegedly gay men were arrested. This was really the first time that I'd realised there was any real serious sort of problem with gay rights in the Middle East. It may sound a bit strange now, but it was just something I wasn't terribly aware of at the time.
You write in your book that Egypt, Lebanon, and Saudi Arabia reflect a range of contrasting experiences when it comes to gay rights. In Egypt, you say there's no law against homosexual acts, yet people are prosecuted and persecuted. In Lebanon, there is a law, but there's also the beginnings of openness for gays. And in Saudi Arabia, you write, in theory, the death penalty applies, but gay men cruise and party undeterred. So let's talk a little bit about life for gays in the Arab world. In Egypt, again, you say there's no laws against homosexual acts. If people are prosecuted, as we just heard, in the Queen Boat case. So what laws are used to prosecute gays if there are no anti-gay laws?
Well, there's a law against habitual debauchery, which can be used for really any sort of sexual activity that the authorities take a dislike to. I think technically it's defined as having sex with more than one person within a period of 3 years. That was originally brought in a long time ago to combat prostitution, and it has since been used against gay men. Another thing is immoral advertising. And this relates to basically gay websites, chat rooms, that sort of thing, where gay Egyptians seeking to make contact with other people have found themselves making contact with undercover police, who then would arrange a meeting with them and have them arrested. So that's the sort of thing that goes on in Egypt.
I'm just thinking about how filled the American jails would be if everybody who had sex with more than one person in 3 years was was prosecuted and put behind bars.
Well, absolutely. I mean, these things are, you know, they're very selective that certain people are unfortunate enough to be caught, and lots of others get away with it. I mean, even in Britain, when homosexuality was illegal here, it was calculated that only one out of about, I think it was 14,000 sexual acts was actually prosecuted.
Now you say in Saudi Arabia there's a death penalty for homosexual acts, but it's seldom enforced. How seldom enforced is it? What exactly does the law say?
Well, you can be executed for all sorts of things in Saudi Arabia, including witchcraft, apostasy, denying religion, all sorts of things. In practice, I found over the last, I think it was 5 years or so, about six executions. And in all those cases, at least according to the Saudi authorities, the people had been involved in more than just having sex with each other. There'd been photography, possibly involvement of minors, and possibly blackmail as well.
Now, you say that in Saudi Arabia that there's cruising and partying. Where and how?
Well, a lot of the partying takes place in private houses, and it's not unusual for large parties to be held in Saudi Arabia. And of course, it's normal for men and women to party separately. So in a sense, that is quite a good cover for people because of the general sexual segregation in Saudi Arabia, that gay people can exploit that. There are a few cafes which are really quite secretive where people meet. There are streets where people cruise and so on. And there have also been a few parties in what are usually called marriage halls, which are big places where you hire a room to hold a party. And there have been a couple of cases where the police have raided those and suspected that it was a gay event.
Now, in terms of private parties in people's homes, you point out that the home is sacrosanct in Saudi Arabia. And tell us more about that.
Well, very much so. I mean, this is a very old sort of idea in Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf countries where because the women are a protected part of the home, it's not a place where people can just rush into. And I think that does make the authorities very reluctant to intrude, except in really very, very serious matters. Also, I think the idea of what happens within the family is not really what happens within the household is not really a matter of concern for the authorities. And you hear all sorts of stories as well about, husbands doing terrible things to members of their families and that sort of thing. But there's a clear distinction between the public and the private. And to some extent, that acts as a safety valve in the kingdom because so many things are forbidden out in the street that if people do things in private, then that allows them to do what they want to some extent without causing a public scandal.
Let's get to Lebanon. You write that in Lebanon there's a law against homosexuality, but at the same time there's the beginning of openness. What is the law?
The law is that unnatural sexual acts, as it says, or unnatural intercourse can be punished. I think it's a jail sentence or a fine. Not a very long jail sentence, but I think it's about a year, something like that. Obviously, the question whether what exactly is meant by unnatural intercourse, and there hasn't really been a test case to challenge that at the moment.
Is this a law that's often applied to homosexuals?
Well, there are a number of prosecutions. It appears at the moment that the Lebanese authorities don't go out looking for people as has happened on occasions in Egypt. I think the law is not applied very often in Lebanon. And because of the particular situation there, where you have a huge diversity of people and attitudes, particularly in Beirut, there's quite a lot of freedom compared with most of the Arab countries.
I got the impression from your book that Beirut actually has some gay clubs.
It does indeed, yes. There's one called the Acid Club, which has been going now for some years. It's quite a large place, probably holds about 400 people, something like that. And it has very loud music. And one of the interesting features about the Acid Club is that men are not allowed to kiss each other or embrace, and they're not supposed to dance too close to each other. And they do have security people patrolling the dance floor in these jackets with the word security written on the back, who will separate male couples if they're dancing too close, or deal with them if they're kissing or anything like that.
So it's understood that you're gay if you're at the club. You're still not allowed to have any body contact.
It's a slightly mixed club. They don't allow body contact. And I have heard of gay couples who take a woman along and they dance sort of in a group of three with the woman between the two men, which is, it's rather comical if you've seen the way these things operate in the West.
With Hezbollah staging these protests in the streets and basically demanding that the government step down, Hezbollah obviously wants more power. Hezbollah would not exactly be gay friendly. So what do you think this new turn in Lebanese politics might mean for the future of gay rights in Lebanon?
I think probably not very much, to be honest. First of all, Hezbollah is rather different from, say, the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. They long ago gave up trying to patrol the beaches and stop women wearing skimpy clothes and that sort of thing. They don't, as far as I can see, try to impose their moral values outside their own religious areas. And Lebanon is very interesting in this way because you have these different groups. You have Christians, you have Shia, Druze, Sunnis, and so on. And within their own areas, they tend to do very much what they want without very much interference from the other groups. So in a way, it's a kind of tolerance which has been brought about by a political stalemate in which no single group can gain total power in the country.
My guest is Brian Whitaker, author of Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Whitaker. He's the Middle East editor of the British newspaper The Guardian and author of the new book Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. You know, one of the things that I found very disturbing in your book was the fact that for a lot of gays in some Arab countries, one of the problems that they face is getting beaten up by members of their own family. Because the gay person in the family is perceived as having, ruined the honor of the family. Tell us one of the stories that you were told.
There was a story from Jordan, which was actually reported in some Canadian newspapers and on a TV program about a Jordanian man who had been married for some years. Even though he knew he was gay, he'd got married, and this is a very common thing in the Middle East because there are huge family pressures for people to get married and to have children. After some years of marriage, he fell in love with a Jordanian man, and he left his wife. Later on, he was found with his male lover by his brother, and the brother threw him down the stairs. He then spent some time in hospital, and the brother came to the hospital and opened fire and shot him in the leg. I don't know whether he intended to kill him, but anyway, he was wounded and was kept in hospital somewhat longer. After he recovered, he was taken to his brother's house and basically imprisoned. I mean, he was kept in a room with bars on the window, and confined there until an aunt who was in Canada intervened and persuaded the family to let him leave Jordan and go to live in Canada. This was agreed by the family, but on the condition that the man signed over all his inheritance rights, his business, his home, his car, and so on, to the brother who'd attacked him. This may be a fairly extreme case, but I have heard of quite a lot of others where a family response has been violent, or they've at least threatened violence. The other reaction, often from maybe the more educated kinds of families, is to regard homosexuality as a form of illness rather than just being bad.
Well, let me just go back to the case that you described. Would it be considered legal for the brother to have, thrown this guy down the stairs and then shot him in the leg and keep him in prison and then take away his property and inheritances? And is that considered acceptable because it is a situation of honor? Or could the brother who did this, could he have been prosecuted?
He could. I mean, this is a very tricky area in the Jordanian legal system where, in theory, obviously it was a very serious assault, but where questions of honour are involved, or the family claims a question of honour is involved, the authorities often take quite a lenient view. I think it's difficult to prove, partly because nobody really has any interest in investigating. I mean, the families, if they're involved in the killing, don't want it to be known, and the authorities really don't feel very inclined to look into it too deeply either.
There are a lot of arranged marriages in the Arab world, and did you meet a lot of people who go through the marriage or go through the arranged marriage and then lead a more underground gay life?
Yes, I've heard of quite a lot of this. I mean, it's something which didn't really sort of occur to me when I started work on the book. I mean, obviously I'd heard that there were lots of arranged marriages, and I never sort of linked that to what happens to gay people. But basically, when young people get into their 20s or so, the family will decide it's time for them to marry and start looking for a husband or wife. And the range of excuses for not marrying is basically pretty limited. I mean, a lot of people will postpone it by trying to stay at university or college as long as possible, some of them by trying to study abroad. But it is quite unusual still, even in the big cities of the Middle East, for people to remain unmarried.
You know, in the United States, gay rights and particularly gay marriage have become very political issues. And, you know, especially the Christian right has been very anti-gay marriage in its activism. There's been a campaign to have, like, state laws or state constitutional amendments banning gay marriage, and a federal amendment to ban gay marriage. Are there any, like, is gay rights, like, a political issue that's, you know, debated in public in any of the Arab states that you've reported from?
Well, it's not so much debated, but I think it's fairly clearly a political issue. And it has been politicized basically by nationalists who want to see homosexuality as a Western perversion. This also applies to some of the Islamists. So it is used as one way of resisting what they see as Western influence, if you like. And you get this quite often in modern Arab novels, where you occasionally get gay relationships, and quite often they involve a Westerner and an Arab, and the relationship turns into a metaphor for Western domination of the Middle East very often. And obviously that, if it's that kind of metaphor, then the relationship being described is going to be a pretty horrible one and a humiliating one for the Arab partner.
You know, I just find it kind of baffling in a way that homosexuality has become this metaphor for, like, Western imperialism, or it's seen as this, like, Western perversion. Isn't homosexuality a part of, like, classic Arab literature? And didn't people like William Burroughs go to countries like Morocco in part because there was a more access to boys, frankly? I mean,
yes. I mean, exactly. I mean, there is a very long history. I mean, some of the most famous classical Arabic poetry, Abu Nuwas and people like that, that is basically gay poetry. You even find, I mean, in the idea of male beauty or male attractiveness is something which has been very widely accepted over a long period, and you even find it in the Quranic vision of paradise, where apart from the virgins, there are rather attractive young men serving people with drinks. And again, more recently, as you mentioned, places like Morocco, a lot of Westerners, Europeans in particular, who were being persecuted in Europe at the time, would go to North Africa or parts of the Middle East where they were able to live with comparative freedom. And of course, you know, in Britain, we had, technically speaking, we had the death penalty for homosexuality until the 1860s. So it's not that long ago that in Britain we were on much the same par as the Saudis. And curiously, if you look at some of the writing of the early European travellers in the 17th and 18th, 19th century to the Middle East, quite a lot of them described the sexual behaviour there in quite extraordinary terms. So, very curiously, the sort of image that is promoted in the Middle East now of homosexuality being part of Western decadence, in the 18th and 19th century, it was described in Europe as a kind of oriental, you know, a strange oriental way of behavior.
Brian Whitaker is the Middle East editor for The Guardian and author of Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Hannibal Rising, the story of how Hannibal Lecter discovered his gifts and became death's prodigy, by Thomas Harris. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Brian Whitaker on gay and lesbian life in the Middle East. Then we'll talk with Noah Satat, the head of a gay rights group in Jerusalem that organizes an annual gay pride parade that has been met with violence. Also, Milo Miles reviews music by Brazilian singer and bandleader Marisa Monche.
Well, I think it's a very open city in lots of ways, not just in terms of sexuality. And, of course, in Israel, they do have positive laws, not just they haven't just made same-sex relations legal, but they do have laws against discrimination and so on. So that's a very positive factor. At the same time, there are religious elements, not so much in Tel Aviv, but in Jerusalem and other parts of the country, which are still very conservative and in some ways very similar to the reactionary Muslims that you find in some of the Arab countries.
You also say that some Palestinians who who end up in Israel because it's more open to gay people, basically face charges from fellow Palestinians of being collaborators.
Yes, it is the way people in the Palestinian territories view it is that if somebody, anybody, goes to live in Israel, then that is seen as quite a serious betrayal of their cause. And of course, it gets very difficult then if somebody goes to Israel and then fails to get residence there and has to go back.
Since it's so difficult to be out of the closet in most Arab countries, was it difficult to get people to talk with you for your book about being gay in the Middle East?
I got a contact in Egypt, first of all, who introduced me to some other people, and that was the way it worked. I had a curious experience in Syria where I met somebody whose family had strong connections with the theatre, and I told him what I was doing. I said, I'm looking for some gay people to interview for the book. Do you know any? And he said, yes, I know plenty. And I said, well, could you help me to set up some interviews? He said, no, I couldn't possibly do that because I'm not supposed to know that they're gay. And so even where people are widely believed to be gay, then it's something which you don't really admit to.
Did people who you interview want to know if you were gay?
They didn't, actually. It's quite curious. No.
I'm. If this is too personal, just say so, but I'm tempted to ask you myself if you're gay and if that affected your access to people one way or another.
Well, yes, I am, but I don't think it did. You go along as a journalist, you know, you're doing a professional job, and it's the same as interviewing anybody else, basically.
Is this a risky book for you to write? Because if you write a book about being gay in the Middle East, a lot of people might assume that you're gay, which you are, and if you're reporting on a part of the world in which it's hard to be out and gay, might you find, like, some of your sources drying up, or, you know, might it be more difficult for you
to
function?
Well, that's something, obviously, that I wondered about and, to some extent, worried about. I think as I proceeded with the book, I got more... you get sort of accustomed to the idea. I mean, what you find, I think, in the Middle East is that people tend to be extremely polite, and they don't raise things. I mean, this is all part of the idea of separating sort of what goes on in private and what goes on in public.
Since there are far more many openly out gays in the West than in the Arab world, and there's gay literature and gay movies and music and everything, do you think that gay people in Arab countries are looking to the West for a sense of what it means to be gay and for a sense of, like, a larger gay identity?
I think there's a very interesting debate beginning to develop in the Middle East about this, because clearly, at the moment, a lot of gay people in the region have nowhere else to look but the West. And I've heard, for example, gay people in Egypt who look at those in Beirut and say, oh, they're just, you know, they're just aping the West. They're copying everything from the West. And one of the activists in Egypt was saying to me, you know, we have to find Arab ways of being gay. And it's something which sounds fine, but when you asked him what exactly he meant, did he have any ideas about what that would involve? He didn't really. So I think it may be that there's a certain universality about this, or it may be that eventually some distinctive Arab gay culture will emerge. It's hard to say at the moment.
Well, Brian Whitaker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Brian Whitaker is the Middle East editor for The Guardian and author of Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. Coming up, we talk with Noah Satat, the head of a group that organizes an annual gay pride parade in Jerusalem. This year, there were violent protests that tried to prevent the march from happening. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Noah Satat, is the executive director of Open House Jerusalem, a gay rights group that has organized an annual gay pride parade in Jerusalem since 2002. Opposition has been strong and sometimes violent. Three people in the parade were stabbed last year. This year, the opposition tried to prevent the parade through violent protests. Noah Satat, welcome to Fresh Air. Why have you been organizing gay rights parades in Jerusalem?
Well, first of all, I'm from Jerusalem. I've been a Jerusalemite all my life, and I struggle for my rights here in my city. Gay pride marches in Jerusalem are really different than in most cities that I know in the U.S., in the sense that pride marches around the world have a celebratory nature, which is very fun, and some of them have a very sexual nature, which is also a lot of fun. Here in Jerusalem, this is a very, very clear political demonstration against oppression.
Well, before we get to some of the violence that you faced, I've noticed just reading the newspapers that opposition to your gay pride parades is the only thing that's effectively united Orthodox Jews with Orthodox Muslims, as well as Christians. United them in opposition to your marches. And I wonder how that makes you feel, knowing the impossibility of finding unity, and this is what they've found unity on.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to them finding unity, so I'm hopeful that once they've found this ridiculous issue to unite over, they may find other issues. But seriously speaking, I'm very disappointed that these respectable religious leaders can only unite over hate when there are so many other important issues in our area.
Some of the most hate-filled literature for this march, I understand, came from Orthodox Jews. There were posters in some ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods encouraging people to make Molotov cocktails in opposition to the marchers.
The amount of hate press against the community in the past months has really been unprecedented. Although we've seen incitement against our community for 4 or 5 years now, the amounts that we've faced in the past month and the direct threats and violence were larger than ever in the past month. And they included threats and violence, directions to the ultra-Orthodox community and on how to act violently against the marchers and other violent threats.
You and the other organizers finally decided to not hold the march in the streets as you customarily have, but rather to move it to a stadium and make it more of a rally than a march. How did you decide? Why did you decide to do that?
About 36 hours before the march was scheduled, there was the tragedy in Beit Hanun where the Israeli Defense Forces killed 19 or 20 Palestinian civilians. This new situation has caused a new security alert in Israel entirely. And the police that were supposed to allocate 12,000 policemen to the security of the march in the streets were unable to commit this amount of forces at the time. So we have had to take a responsible stance and change our plans.
Now, last year, I understand that somebody stabbed three people who were participating in the march. What happened with that, and what was your personal reaction to it?
Well, the last year's march in June 2005, there were 800 policemen escorting the march, and despite the very heavy security force, an ultra-Orthodox man managed to step into the crowd and stab three of the participants. I was very close to the stabbing, very, very close, and one of the teenagers who was stabbed, one of them was 18 years old, as he was taken to the hospital, asked me to continue the march and said that he would march again at the head of the march this year. He actually spoke at the rally 3 weeks ago.
Did he recover fully from the stabbing?
Yeah, all the three people who were stabbed have recovered since. And the attacker was sentenced to 12 years in prison for attempted murder.
Now, I understand that this year somebody put a curse on you.
Yes.
Well, tell us a story.
The amount of incitement against the community also culminated in a very intense effort to undermine me personally. So there is a curse called Pusa Denua. It's an ancient Kabbalic curse, which basically is a curse of death. It's not very often used and it's not widely believed in, but it is a sign of a very, very radical struggle against someone. So the Pusa Denua curse was also used on Yitzhak Rabin before he was murdered. Mainly it's used against heads of states. And it was used against me just before the march as a sign of the... it was just a sign to the amount of violence that we had to face here.
How was the so-called curse put upon you?
It's a ritual. It's performed at midnight and there's fire. It's very pagan in how it's portrayed, but it's a whole ceremony.
So it's a ceremony.
Rabbis gathering together to put a curse on somebody's head and.
Rabbis gathering together?
Yeah, and reciting phrases in Aramaic.
So obviously this was done not in your presence.
No.
How were you informed about it?
This is very rare. It doesn't happen often. I think it happens about once a year in Israel. Some reporters were covering it.
Oh, some reporters were actually present at the ceremony?
Yeah, it is illegal to do this in Israel.
I wonder if you think that Israel has a kind of like macho self-image, and if gay men are seen in Israel as being like more effeminate and less macho, and if that affects how gay rights are perceived.
That's an excellent question. I think you're very right. The heterosexist macho culture in Israel is sometimes very threatened by any gender blending ideas. So I think that the military nature of our society does impact how people view GLBT rights. On the other hand, I can tell you that in Israel, the GLBT people participate in the military, and that is a very crucial side of our acceptance in society.
As part of your gay rights group Open House, you have a component within that speak specifically to the needs of Palestinians and other Arabs who are gay. Would you tell us about that part of your program?
Sure. We run, I believe, the largest GLBT program in Arabic in the world. And we have several community building projects throughout Israel for Palestinians. And the Palestinian society, like other societies in Israel, is very, very conservative. And hence the need to really enforce the building of positive LGBT identities within the Palestinian community. For instance, our group, together with a group in Lebanon, are thinking of how to coined the term for coming out of the closet in Arabic. And just a few years ago, they've invented the term for gay that is not derogative. We're building the very foundations of a community for an Arab and a Palestinian LGBT community.
What are some of the issues that Palestinian gay and lesbian people have brought to your attention that show some of the problems that they face in Palestinian culture being gay?
Well, the Palestinian society is very, very conservative, very strict about issues of sex, and people who are gay are sometimes expelled from their families, sometimes violently threatened, and almost always are somewhat outcast from the society. One of the major issues that Palestinians, that GLBT and non-GLBT face right now is access. Ramallah is about 15 miles from where I'm sitting right now, which is very close to the Jerusalem Open House. I've just today, it's now 4 o'clock here in Jerusalem, and I have, before I left to come here, I've met a Palestinian gay man who came from Ramallah, and he has left his house at 5 a.m. this morning and only now reached the open house. That's the amount of effort that people engage in trying to reach community, and this is the only alternative that GLBT people in Palestine have. They need to find a way to reach community outside of Palestine, and this is a very, very difficult task.
What was your parents' reaction when you came out, and how has that reaction been affected by the death threats that have been put on you as a result of your work as a gay activist?
I can tell you that my parents right now are very supportive, and they've had a rough time sleeping in the past few weeks. But I think that they share the goals of the struggle with me and they have not changed their minds because of the violence.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Noah Sattat spoke to us from Jerusalem. She's the executive director of Open House Jerusalem. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews music by the Brazilian singer and bandleader Marisa Monche. This is Fresh Air. Brazilian singer, songwriter, and bandleader Marisa Monche is the model of a modern diva. She produces her own records, organizes bands, and shapes every aspect of her career, which has resulted in a cult following in North America and hit records in South America. She has a pair of new albums and was on tour when critic Milo Miles saw her perform last month.
Difícil de ler, faça a sua parte. Eu sou daqui, eu não sou de Marte. Vem, cara, me repara. Não vê, tá na cara. Sou porta-bandeira de mim.
Orisha Manche's recent Miami performance was close to what I imagined a perfect world music show would be like when I first got interested in international pop. South Florida is home to many exotic species, the human variety a relentless mix of exquisite beauty and excessive girth. But folks of every shade and age blended together at the sold-out show, united by Marisha fandom. It was a glimpse of a world without boundaries of gender or generations or even language. Miami is bilingual Spanish-English, but of course Manche sings Brazilian Portuguese. Manche's eclectic audience reflects her skill with eclectic musics. Though she doesn't like to be classified, she's really the youngest and perhaps last exponent of tropicalismo, the Brazilian response to rock and roll that began in the late 1960s. This shows up in her pop instincts. When she needs a big encore number, she goes for a stomper that suggests a tropicalismo reinvention of Gimme Shelter. With her deft nine-piece band, she made the plan seem spontaneous and careful control feel like a game. She lures you into sweeter and softer tunes by hitching them to vibrant, articulate melodies that sound like old friends the second time you hear them. Plus, she can write a samba that sounds modern, but as timeless as one 50 years old.
Tarde já de manhã cedinho, quando a névoa toma conta da cidade, quem pega no violão sou eu, pra cantar a novidade. Quantas lágrimas de orvalho na roseira, todo mundo tem um canto de tristeza. Graças a Deus um passarinho vem me acompanhar cantando bem baixinho. Eu já não me sinto só, tão só, tão só, com o universo ao meu redor. Laia.
Manche recently released two albums at once, Universo Omorador, original and vintage sambas, and Infinito Particular, a gorgeous but insistently intimate and low-key modern pop collection. All of her styles have more force on stage. When she puts down her sturdy guitar or charming harmonica and does the diva thing, all waving willow arms and serpentine waist, the audience melts. But she's become a potent and confident bandleader as well. She featured each player in a number after she introduced him. Special mention should go to bassist and guitarist Daji and Mauro Diniz on cavaquinho, the traditional samba guitar. The most special stage effect came during the vintage samba My Canary, where a pair of red paper cubes were blown about in an ornate cage, looking for all the world like two nervous, flirting birds. A perfect complement to the song's theme of uncertain love.
Pela primeira vez eu chorei, porque fui desprezado pelo meu amor. O meu barraco agora ficou desarrumado. O meu canário já não canta, com certeza se desgostou. Piu, 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 piu. Canta meu canarinho para amenizar a minha dor. Piu, piu.
Manche's dramatic skills were in full effect for the erotic agonies of Carnalismo from the hit album Tribalistas. But my favorite Manche moment was when she used a made-up word to cast a dreamy electronic mood in Pernambuco Buco Lismo.
Eu vou fazer.
The Gusman Center for the Performing Arts provided a marvelous setting that deserves comment itself. The place began life as the Olympia Movie Theater in 1926 and was the first air-conditioned building in the South. The restored original design is an atmospheric fantasy by John Eberson, meant to suggest sitting in the open-air courtyard of an opulent Spanish mansion, complete with statues and fountains and peacocks. The ceiling-projected night sky of twinkling stars and passing clouds is remarkable. For a moment, I thought the place somehow didn't have a roof. Everyone from Elvis Presley to Pavarotti has played the Gusman. Marisha Monche was a very worthy addition to the historic roster.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. Marisa Monche spells her last name M-O-N-T-E. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From Kay and Matthew Buxbaum, whose Buxbaum International Fellowship trains journalists for reporting from all over the world. Details are at npr.org. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West, by Bezard Yagmayan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The desegregation of schools, the constitutional right to privacy, Miranda rights, and the outlawing of prayer in the public school were established in rulings by the Warren Court. There was a movement on the far right to impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren. On the next Fresh Air, Jim Newton discusses his new biography of Warren. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.